This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Consideration of matters pertaining to medical ethics. We've looked at some general principles pertaining to medical ethics and complicated questions of artificial insemination, genetic engineering, two specific questions that come up at the beginning of life. Third question that we really would be irresponsible to avoid, although a lot has been said in our day about it, a third question pertaining to the beginning of life that obviously has ethical overtones is the question of abortion. And so what I would like to do here is to summarize the case against abortion and try to provide some information on that, and then advance the subject by addressing at the end of this lecture the question, is abortion ever justifiable? Is it ever justifiable? On that particular question, I find evangelicals are curiously divided, and so I trust that we won't simply be rehashing what many of you will know already about abortion, but we'll make some constructive, positive advance as well. At least I hope so. Abortion, as you should know, has become something of the new American way of life, which is a strange way of putting it. It's really the American way of death now. In 1967, liberalized abortion laws were introduced in California, Colorado, and North Carolina. In 1970, abortion on demand was introduced in Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, and New York. Rockefeller had vetoed the repeal of a New York law a year later. 1972, easy abortion proposals were overwhelmingly defeated in Michigan and North Dakota. But 2 months later, on January 22, 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a margin of 7 votes to 2, established abortion as a, quote, constitutional right in the famous case of Roe versus Wade. After the Supreme Court decision of Roe versus Wade, it's been virtually impossible for a state to do anything to protect developing life. For that decision allows late abortions that are deemed infanticides in other civilized nations. In our country, late abortions are allowed up to the 6th month. In the first trimester, abortion is allowed on demand without regulation, according to the Supreme Court decision. In the second trimester, it is regulated with reference to the mother's health. And in the third trimester, abortion is always allowable in case of a threat to the mother's health, and this is the real kicker, even if we mean by that the mother's, quote, mental health. So that conceivably, a woman who in the 8th month of her pregnancy decides that this is going to be an intolerable, oppressive intrusion into her life to have a new child and just can't function, just can't wash the dishes and do the ironing and the housework day by day because she's fretting over this, could go and supposedly have a doctor certify that she's in this condition, and abortion would thus be allowed. Well, now, in that circumstance, although there is talk about regulations in the second trimester and the fact that even in the third trimester it has to be for the mental health or health of some sense of the mother, the fact of the matter is that this approach allows abortion at any time up to the moment of birth. And thus, I believe that we can say with all honesty that, words aside, the Supreme Court virtually approved abortion on demand. Virtually approved abortion on demand. The abortion business has seen great growth. Indeed, it perhaps is the business that has seen the greatest growth in the last decade. 5,000% increase in this business from 1969 to 1975 alone. There were 20,000 abortions in 1969 in this country, it's estimated, and over 1 million abortions in 1975, and most recent statistics indicate that it's now about 2 million abortions a year in our day and age. This is far greater growth than even the oil business has seen, which is ironic in light of the fact that our society screams bloody murder at the gross profits and increase of business of the oil company. But nobody seems to have a word to say about the business angle of abortion. Indeed, abortion is one of the most financially prosperous businesses in operation. Since the 1973 Supreme Court decision, abortion has become the most common surgical procedure that is performed in the United States. There are over 2 million annually. More abortions are performed than live births in some areas of our country. For instance, in 1976, around Washington, D.C., there were more abortions than children born. In 1975, 1 in 4 pregnancies ended in abortion in the United States. And in 1979, it was 1 in 4 in the world that ended in abortion. So that more deaths are being caused by abortion today than by any other known cause, cancer and heart disease included. Of course, there's an irony. In these introductory remarks, I'd like to point out there's an irony in that our society opposes capital punishment in many cases, and the people who oppose capital punishment nevertheless endorse abortion. There's real irony in the case of our society seeking to find a mother who slaughtered her newborn baby and yet condoning a doctor who destroys only one twin while the other one is born alive. And you have a mother who gives birth to a child in an apartment building in New York and throws the child out the window, and we pursue her and prosecute her. And yet you have a doctor who tries to abort twin children, one dies and the other one he sustains, and we don't prosecute him for killing the one. It's just really hard, no matter what your sympathies are, to understand the inconsistency in our society. Why should you work desperately to sustain the life of the one twin who was born when you've just finished killing the twin's brother? As a matter of fact, all these ironies just point to the fact that we're undergoing a major social revolution in our values in this country, a revolution in values endorsing such things as selfishness and a lack of regard for the inalienable rights of unseen others. You see, it's pretty easy for us to get all worked up and defend the rights of people that we can see, but when we can't see the child, then often enough the inalienable rights are forgotten. We have changed in our outlook from the paramount importance of the sanctity of life, so that in past generations abortion was in fact called infanticide, to the worth and the quality of one's lifestyle being the most important value, so that what is formerly an atrocity is becoming a daily relief for people to improve the quality of their lifestyle. Abortion is now so common as to have a psychologically deadening effect upon people. I think even Christians now are so accustomed to hearing the gross statistics that, you know, it just has lost its shock value, which means that we have lost some of our values in terms of the sanctity of human life. Life is no longer absolute in the eyes of some people. It's become a value that is secondary to convenience, personal fulfillment, financial cost. We have here, in fact, a list of our new idolatries, those for which we will sacrifice our children, just as assuredly as the Moloch worshippers sacrificed their children in the Old Testament. Well, it won't be necessary in this setting to tell you very much about abortion in terms of its procedures and the categories of abortion. Common procedures of abortion are now fairly well known, and it really doesn't affect the morality of abortion whichever procedure a person uses. The fact is they're putting an end to a life, and we will argue that that is a human life. I think a basic case can be made against abortion. Utilitarian grounds alone would exist for opposing abortion because of all of the bad consequences of it, psychological consequences to the mother, the lack of respect for human life that is engendered, and therefore the abuse of other children, the lack of a workforce, the cutting off of our own heritage by destroying our children. We can go on and on and on. There are plenty of consequential reasons why abortion should be opposed, but basically we oppose abortion because it amounts to the killing of innocent life, innocent human life, and is thus a case of murder. Abortion, as I've said, has many bad consequences. It is not safe for women. I've asked you to read this very well done book by Harold O.J. Brown, Death Before Birth, and this will give you a lot of details on things that I'm only going to pass over very quickly. abortion has been shown to be not a safe procedure for women and has medical complications for them. There are psychiatric complications that we could pursue. There's been an increase in child abuse since the approval of abortion in this country. The ability to support retired people, the drop in our workforce, the lack of a healthy young generation is developing all around us. Abortion leads easily to disrespect for the dignity of life. It seems to me opens the door right away for consideration of the acceptability of euthanasia. But the basic argument, nevertheless, is this. A fetus is a human life, and the government ought not to sanction the taking of a human life, except in cases of public justice and self-defense. The Christian view is that man was made in the image of God, and as such, man has dignity and value. Indeed, when Christianity came on the scene into the ancient world, abortion rapidly declined and disappeared in Western civilization. Christians do not see human beings as some kind of absurd accident of the space-time continuum plus chance, but rather creations in the image of God. And for that reason, the Christian view is that abortion is an atrocity. It's a wanton destruction of a developing human life, and indeed is terribly criminal. But what is to be seen as an atrocity, as I've already said, is becoming gradually familiar and even desirable in our society. Now, Roe versus Wade, that famous Supreme Court decision, argued that the fetus is not a human life, quote, in the full sense. This much can be said for that absurd remark, and it is absurd. It can be said, at least, that this preserved the outward appearance of ethical decency. Because if somebody said the fetus is fully a human being, but you can kill it anyway, then there wouldn't be any kind of decency, ethical decency, apparent. But by saying that it's not fully a human being, then it appears that maybe there's some room for us to go ahead and take the life of the fetus. For you see, if the fetus is fully a human being, our Supreme Court justices would have to admit that killing the fetus is homicide. Killing of a human. Homicide. And I think desire for this line of argument that abortion amounts to homicide to be overlooked, the desire to avoid it, is rather clear from the euphemisms that are so often employed by abortionists. For instance, abortion is sometimes called the prevention of birth defects. No, it's not the prevention of birth defects, it's the elimination of a birth. It's the elimination of defectives, or what are viewed as defectives. The fetus is spoken of, the embryo, instead of the baby or the child. We speak of the product of conception rather than the baby within the womb. It's very interesting, by the way. Studies have been done comparing the language used by women before and after the decisions for or against abortion. While they're contemplating abortion, it's always the fetus. When they've decided not to, it's their baby. Before they consider abortion, they have a baby. But when they're going to go in for the abortion, then they have a fetus. You know, the very use of people's language tells you how their conscience bothers them. We don't speak of the killing of a human life, we speak of the termination of a human life. The fact of the matter is, the fetus is a human life. And for all the circumlocutions, all the euphemisms, fetus is a human being. It is an individual entity of the human genus. It is not a vegetable. It's not a mineral. It's not a fish. It's not a fowl. It's not a horse. It's not a rock. I mean, you have to say it's living. Any scientist will tell you it's living. And then you have to decide what kind of life it is. And obviously, it's human life. This is not a mere word quibble here. Remember that Hitler played with words, too, using such techniques to persuade the Germans to close their eyes to the extermination of the Jews, who were called worthless, people without value. The fetus is a human being, and we should insist on using that language. Now, there are many pro-abortionists who admit quite openly that abortion does destroy a human life. For instance, in The New Republic, 1977, we read, there clearly is no logical or moral distinction between a fetus and a young baby. Free availability of abortion cannot be reasonably distinguished from euthanasia. It is too facile to say that human life is always sacred, however. Obviously it is not, and the social cost of preserving Against the mother's will, the lives of fetuses who are not yet self-conscious is simply too great. See, so the New Republic here gives a rather candid expression to the fact that the fetus is a human being, but there are some values that even outweigh the value of human life. Should abortion be a legal option? Well, I think that we have to recognize logically that the crux of the question is the status of the fetus. Various cases have been made for the legality of abortion, but all of the cases made in favor of abortion can be counter-instanced, can be rebutted, by pointing to the fact that the fetus is a human being. There are some cases in favor of the legal right of abortion which claim that something about abortion itself justifies us in treating it differently than other cases of taking a human life. There's something about abortion itself that justifies us in treating it differently than other cases of taking a human life. For instance, in the case of abortion, the mother's conscience should not be violated in a pluralistic society. Another case, the mother has rights over her own body, or abortion should be justified as a way of population control. Well, in answer to that, a mother's freedom of choice and a matter of the mother's conscience do not justify her destroying a human life, even if it is now existing within her own human body. I was once asked in Jackson, Mississippi, on a program that was talking about abortion, whether we as Christians don't recognize the woman's right to her own body. And I answered, yes, as a matter of fact, we do, but that the fetus is not her own body, that the fetus is simply in her own body, and she does not have a right anymore to get in a car and to run over somebody that's not her body. She has no more the right to do that. Even as she doesn't have the right to do that, she no more has the right to destroy a life that's within her. So it's not her body. And mothers do not have the right to kill their children, whether they're inside or outside their body. And is abortion just another form of birth control? No, as a matter of fact, birth control prevents new life from beginning, whereas abortion kills a new life that has already begun. So there aren't any good cases pertaining to abortion in general, situation as a whole. There are some arguments, however, confined to special cases for abortion. Not all abortions would be legitimate, but there are cases where abortion is legitimate in terms of the bad consequences that are going to follow. And we think here of cases like rape, the likelihood of a handicapped child being born, the situation where the child's going to be unwanted by the parents, so it become a problem to the rest of the family, situation where the mother might injure herself if she had to go to a quack doctor and abortion wasn't legalized, situation where we feel like we have to defend a law that makes abortion legitimate because otherwise the poor will be discriminated against. They won't be able to get abortions, even though the rich will be able to. That is, the rich can go against the law. They can fly to Mexico and have their abortion, but the poor can't, and therefore prohibiting abortion works to discriminate against the poor. Well, these are hard cases in some situations. Some of these are hard cases, I admit. But an old proverb says that hard cases make for bad law, and that's very true here, too. You don't look at the hard case, you look at the normal case when you decide what your law should be. Before we hastily accept abortion as a solution to these hard cases, let's take time to analyze what such a solution would imply about our own values. It seems to me that rape and handicapped children and unwanted children are indeed serious problems, but not so serious as to justify the taking of an innocent human life. Okay, let's look at rape. In most cases, rape doesn't lead to pregnancy anyway, and most people know that. But in those few cases where rape does lead to a pregnancy, if you kill the fetus, what you are doing is punishing an individual who had nothing to do with the circumstance. It's totally an innocent third party. Granted, there's a biological connection, but the fetus is an innocent third party that had nothing to do with it. Seems to me, instead of killing the fetus, you ought to execute the rapist. That's what God's law calls for. You punish the perpetrator of the crime rather than the child that's come about because of the crime. Rape is a hard situation to counsel women regarding, but nevertheless, we must counsel them that their conscience will not feel any better if they now add to this disgusting intrusion into their lives, they add to it a murder where they kill their own child. How about a case where it seems that a handicapped child is very likely going to be born? Well, if we can eliminate the distress of a child being handicapped while the child is within the mother, one must wonder, with all logical consistency, why we can't eliminate the child after it's born. I mean, if a handicapped child seems to be having an unhappy and miserable life, why shouldn't we at that point eliminate the child? What is it about not being able to see the fetus that makes it morally all right to kill it, but once you see it, you can't? It just doesn't make a bit of sense. If somebody says that children are unwanted, I always am tempted to say, unwanted by whom? Because I know plenty of people in this world who want children, who can't have their own. Even unwanted children, there's a better solution to the situation other than murdering them. After all, there are children that are made unwanted even after initially being wanted, too. Do we then say, well, children who are walking the streets being abandoned by their parents should be killed? No, we don't. The argument that always gets to me, by the way, is the one that says, well, women are going to be hurt by quacks if we don't legalize abortion, so they can go to good doctors and have the procedure done in a safe and clean way. Well, it seems to me that line of reasoning just as much would lead to the conclusion that we should legalize terrorist bombing of people, that it shouldn't be against the law to make a terrorist bomb. Because don't you see that if it's not against the law, then we can develop safe and sane facilities, laboratories and all the rest, for the construction of these bombs. But if you prohibit people from doing it, then those people who are going to do it anyway are going to have to do it in back alleys and in apartment buildings and bring in their own stuff and unsafely try to mix these things, and then they're going to get blown up. So if we don't want people to get blown up, what we ought to do is to allow people to make terrorist bombs, which are going to be used, by the way, to blow other people up. Doesn't make a bit of sense. I think if we don't want women to get hurt and possibly die from quack doctors, we should allow them to have safe and sane abortions, which, by the way, are going to injure and make other people dead, namely the fetuses that are involved. This is just insanity to reason this way. There are also people who say we can't prohibit abortion because then rich people will still get them and poor people won't be able to. I guess we shouldn't prohibit anything that rich people can buy then, right? Rich people can buy drugs and can buy hitmen to kill people and can do all sorts of things that poor people can't. But there are some things that riches buy that aren't worth buying. And the death of an innocent human being is just one of them. And so it doesn't seem to me that we have a very good case presented for abortion in all cases, opening the door to any abortion because of the woman's conscience or the rights over her own body or what have you. And nor do we have any particular specialized cases where abortion would be legitimate either. Okay, finally, there are therapeutic arguments that are offered in favor of abortion, therapeutic arguments pertaining to the mother's health. Of course, these come down to either her psychological health or her physical health. Now, is it true that women will suffer psychological damage if they bear their children? Can mental health considerations really justify abortion? Let me give you a few interesting statistics here. In 1970, of the 60,000 abortions performed in my state of California, 98.3% of them were allegedly done for the mental health of the mother. Now, that statistic in itself is rather shocking. 98%? Of the women who needed an abortion out of 60,000 instances would have had mental health problems if they had their children. Well, that's hard to swallow. But even if you swallow it, what I'd like you to see is, by comparison, in the same year, in the state of New York, where that subterfuge was unnecessary, New York would allow an abortion apart from the mental health of the mother. 3% were listed as abortions that took place for mental health reasons. Now, I know some people can say that goes to show you there are a lot of mentally unstable women in California. But I dare say that the comparison, even if California is mentally unstable, would not be that gross, from 3% to 98%. it should be rather obvious that this amounts to abortion on demand when it is enlisted at all, and that people appeal to mental health if that's the only thing that the law will give them as a way to get rid of their unwanted children. The whole idea of mental health is rather ambiguous, too. One wonders how you can make good law from an ambiguous concept like mental health. In fact, serious moral and emotional disorders often arise, and more often arise, it seems to me, because an abortion is performed rather than if an abortion will not be performed. I would not only dispute the concept of psychological illness as a category mistake, treating the mind as though it were a body. Bodies are ill. Minds, it seems to me, are distorted, confused, sinful, and all the rest. And I don't know of any evidence, I should add this too, I don't know of any evidence that has been set forth by anybody to show that psychological good comes about through the use of abortion. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any controlled research in that area. With respect to the physical health of the mother, let me remind you that there's little, if any, threat or danger of maternal death simply from pregnancy. And of the times that I've debated the abortion issue on university campuses, this is the one thing that people just always want to come back to, is that obviously there are cases where the life of the mother is in danger because of the fetus. Well, what I'm here to tell you is that obviously there are no known cases of that. Here's the most obvious thing that's thrown up as an example, a tubal pregnancy, where if the pregnancy goes to term, the tubes will burst and the woman will bleed to death. Well, there is a matter of fact, just to be logical here, the danger is in the unknown pregnancy or the unknown tubal location of the pregnancy and not in the tubal pregnancy itself. When the doctors know in advance that the fetus is developing in the tubes, they merely have to hospitalize the woman and at the appropriate time take the child in advance. That is a premature birth under controlled circumstances. Moreover, the doctors, if they know that the woman's going to give birth after term and that her tubes are going to burst, the fact that she's hospitalized means that they have at their disposal facilities for stopping the bleeding and saving her life. So again, it's not the tubal pregnancy that is the threat to the mother's life. It's the ignorance of the tubal pregnancy that's the threat to the mother's life. Moreover, in 1951, Dr. Pepperin of Tufts University stated, 1951 means 20 years before the argument comes into full swing, he said, anyone who performs a therapeutic abortion today is either ignorant of modern medical methods of treating the complications of pregnancy or is unwilling to take the time to use them. So, we've looked at the various reasons that have been offered for an abortion, reasons that apply across the board, matters of conscience, the right over your own body, and what have you. We've looked at the reasons that justify some abortions on the basis of their consequences, rape, the possibility of a handicapped child, and all the rest. We've looked at therapeutic reasons for abortion, and what we come up with is no reason at all for an abortion. There doesn't seem to be any legal grounds for an abortion, and that then brings us back to the key question that I stated in the very beginning here. The key question is the status of the fetus. The status of a fetus is not a scientific question, by the way. It's a religious question. When we're looking at ethical matter, religious matter like this, we obviously have to depend upon the revelation of God. And in the revelation of God, we see, first of all, a general concern for human life. That's evident from cover to cover in the Bible. And secondly, we see a particular case made against abortion in the 21st chapter of the book of Exodus. Well, first step in the argument then is to show God's concern to preserve human life. Just as we must honor God, we must not strike God's creation. Since man is made in the image of God, to strike out against man is to strike out against God himself. And so we remember the curse on Cain, the prohibition of murder in Genesis 9 given to Noah. Remember the sixth commandment in the Mosaic law, thou shalt not slay. By the way, the word slay there is always used of human beings. In fact, even in cases of accidental killing, as in Numbers 25, Deuteronomy 19, and Joshua 20, cities of refuge are provided to protect the slayer against the avenger of blood. Even in accidental cases, then, there is some form of penalty. The man has to run to the city of refuge and wait for the fair adjudication of his case. Careless killing is forbidden by the Sixth Commandment, as well as intentional killing, by the way. In Matthew 5, Jesus goes so far as to say that unrighteous anger is a form of killing, and even that is to be prohibited. In 1 John 3:5, John says that hatred is murder. And therefore, the Sixth Commandment shows how extremely high God's regard for life is. God says you are not to maliciously, accidentally, irresponsibly take human life. You're not to have unrighteous anger. You're not even to speak against your brother without proper cause. So the first step in my argument is just to say, in general, human life is valuable and is to be protected. But secondly, we should see that Scripture everywhere assumes that the fetus is a human being. In Genesis 25 and Hosea 12, we read that two children were in Rebekah's womb. Two children, not two fetuses, using the euphemism there. In Job 10, we read that God fashioned Job's body and granted him life. In Psalm 139, God is the one who formed David's inward parts while in the womb, and God beheld his unformed substance, and David was considered a sinner from the moment of his conception. In Isaiah 44, we read that God formed the prophet from the womb and called him by name. In Jeremiah 20, the destroying of an unborn baby is called a killing, the same word used of killing a born individual. In Luke 1, verses 41 to 44, the same word is used for the unborn baby as for children that are already born, that is, children after birth. In Galatians 1:15, we read that Paul was consecrated from his mother's womb. In fact, there is no scriptural evidence that the fetus is less than a human being from the point of conception. We have just the opposite. Scripture speaks of unborn children with the language of personhood and never speaks of children in any other way. Fetus is never treated merely as a part of the mother's body, just as some kind of biological extension. The fetus is always considered a human being. So the first step in our argument is that the Bible says we must protect human life, even to the extreme of not having hateful thoughts or words, and the Bible always presents the fetus as a human being. Ergo, it follows that we must protect the fetus's life. But there's specific confirmation of this in Exodus 21, verses 22 to 25. We have a specific law from God that would, by application, forbid abortion. Exodus 21, beginning at verse 22, if men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, and yet no harm follow, he shall surely be fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, controversy has surrounded this passage because of two different interpretations of it. One interpretation says that as these men are fighting and they hurt the woman with child, that her fruit departing amounts to a miscarriage. And then the passage goes on that if that happens, there shall be a fine. But then if harm follows, life for life. That is, if harm follows to the mother, then it's life for life. So that's the miscarriage interpretation of this passage. The premature birth interpretation of this passage says that if her fruit departs, that means she gives a premature birth to the child, and if no harm follows, there's still a fine, because that's how important it is. But if harm follows to the now-born child or to the mother, it's life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So now, which interpretation should we prefer? Verse 22 speaks of the fruit departing, yalad yatzah in the Hebrew. Yalad, by the way, in the Hebrew is the normal word for a child. Indeed, it's the word often used for a fully formed infant. Yatzah is the Hebrew verb that simply means to depart, to go out. And so what we read here quite literally is, if her child goes out. And yatzah is used elsewhere in the Bible, by the way, for normal birth. And so I think you have to say here, we have a live birth. It's premature, and there's nothing in the passage that suggests that it's a miscarriage. Indeed, other terms are used for the result of the process, as well as the process itself, if the miscarriage interpretation were to be preferred. You would have a nefesh and shakol used instead of yalad yatzah. and thus the undesignated harm spoken of in the passage must apply either to the mother or the child without distinction. That being true, it turns out that the child in this passage, even as it's a fetus, is accorded human status and full value equal with that of the mother's, because the child is seen as a separate life, fully human, and to be legally protected, even to the point of the death penalty. And in fact, the protection of the child is greater than the protection given to somebody who's already been born. Because in the case of an accidental death in the Old Testament law, a man does not die. That is, the person who is guilty of the accidental death would not die. In this case, even though it's accidental, the person should die. It's life for life. Even though the death is not premeditated, the fetus is given legal protection to the point of the death penalty, even in an accidental circumstance. And so from the biblical perspective, there is no question that the fetus is a human being, and God forbids the killing of human beings, and we have the specific confirmation of Exodus 21 behind that. So the conclusion that we have to come to after examining the case for abortion, or the attempted case for abortion, and the case against it, is that our country today is engaging in incredible infanticide. Although medical and philosophical arguments might only show probable personhood for the fetus, God's revelation requires that we treat the unborn child as a person from the point of conception. And the scripture requires that we avoid any kind of conduct which would lead to the destruction of a human life, even to the point of having attitudes that are destructive of human life. And if the fetus is a human being, then there's an incredible amount of murder going on. The only difference, in fact, between the genocide practiced in Hitler's day and that being practiced today, the infanticide today, is that the victims of an abortion cannot speak for themselves. The Jews were not in a very good position in Hitler's day, but at least they could run, they could fight, they could speak for themselves in a court of law. Fetuses cannot. Christians throughout the Bible, God's people throughout the Bible, and the law of God are called upon to plead the cause of the poor and the needy, those who in a court of law are defenseless, those who have no voice in the society. The fetus today is in exactly that functionally equivalent position. One of the Nazi judges that was condemned at the Nuremberg trials said, quite tellingly, "I never knew it would come to this." And the reply of an American judge at Nuremberg was this: "It came to this the first time you condemned an innocent life." Do we in this country have to wait until it comes to something where the blood flows in the streets and we say, "We didn't have any idea that it would come to this"? The fact is, it has already come to that in principle when we allow any innocent human life to be sacrificed. Well, what would God require us to do? God would require us to speak out, to plead the cause of the poor and the needy, and to take all measures to protect their lives. Let's not surrender to the moral trend of our day that views human life as low as garbage to be cast out in a waste can. Let's hear Isaiah 5:20, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for life." We need, obviously, to be doing something about abortion. It isn't my job here to talk about logistics and programs and procedures, but I would like to say that what we are doing, most of us, in the Evangelical Christian Church is not nearly enough. In fact, it's not nearly enough even for me to give lectures on this matter, and we need to be mobilized that politically something is going to take place to reverse the terrible, murderous trend in our day. However, I don't believe we have the right to go so far as to wage war against abortionists to destroy their abortion plants or to kill the doctors who are doing abortions and that sort of thing. At least we don't have cause to do that until our society finally falls into civil war over the issue. Until such time as we have exhausted every peaceable and legal means for altering the situation, we as Christians have no right to take up arms against it. However, I don't preclude the possibility that our society is in such a bad case that that day may come. Well, now I want to kind of go a step beyond. I've summarized what you can find in the book that I've assigned and other literature. I hope I've brought it together in a convenient way, packaged it so that it's digestible. But I would like to now extend my remarks. I'd like to go a step further and ask the question, is abortion ever justified? Because there are some people, in fact, there are some people who would call themselves theonomists even, those who hold to the validity of God's law, who say that abortion is justified, at least in the case where the mother's life is at stake, where the mother's life is compromised by the continuing development of the child. There are some people who say that we're just wrong to say there aren't such cases. And there are some people who say that even though we don't know of such cases, they might develop in the future. And if they ever did, then we have to know what to do. And what we should do is prefer the mother's life to that of the fetus. Well, I'm going to ask that question, hypothetically or realistically, is abortion ever justified for the sake of the protection of the mother? The Sixth Commandment does not forbid all intentional killing of human beings in all situations. Certain categories of exception are laid down by God Himself, the lawgiver. As the larger Catechism of the Westminster Confession indicates, the Sixth Commandment forbids all taking away of the life of ourselves or others, quote, except in case of public justice, lawful war, or necessary defense. That's question 136. Very simply put, intentional killing is legitimate, we are told, in cases of capital punishment, just war, and self-defense. Along these lines, then, we need to ask, does anything in Scripture have the force of limiting the protection due to the unborn human child? Abortion certainly could not be justified within the category of capital punishment. And that for the simple reason that an unborn child can never be legally convicted of a crime. You can't take an unborn child into a court of law and convict it, and therefore you never could have a capital punishment of a child. Moreover, killing an unborn child during war would be in the same category as killing any other civilian in a time of war, and so it's no special case. And it makes no ethical sense to speak of declaring selective war on an individual fetus. I mean, how could the United States say, we declare war on the fetus and Mrs. Jones? I mean, there would be no just occasion for doing that. So it could never be justified in terms of a warfare situation. And so what we are reduced to, finally, is the rationale of self-defense. Some might wish to argue that in some admittedly rare situations, the continued existence of an unborn child is incompatible with the continued existence of the mother. One life must be forfeited. Here, abortion would be a matter of self-defense and necessary in order to save the life of the mother. The Sixth Commandment requires diligent efforts to preserve human life, and thus it would be at least as great a sin to allow the mother to die without taking available measures to save her as to kill the child. Indeed, the mother would be killed by our inaction. The basic problem with the plea of self-defense in cases of abortion is evident, however, when people say that abortion can be justified only in those cases when the fetus presents material aggression against the mother. This was once said by Bruce Waltke in the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, Volume 19. The fact is that the plea of self-defense is inapplicable precisely because there is no aggression on the part of the fetus against its mother. In Scripture, the exoneration of self-defense applies to cases of assault, that is, perceived or potential assault. The basic passage of Scripture here is Exodus 22, verse 2. It must be observed that the Bible is very circumspect regarding the precise conditions for the plea of self-defense, namely, the assumption of intent on the part of the assailant to do bodily harm or to kill has to be there. The killing of a thief surprised in the darkness of night does not bring with it blood guilt, because not only can no intent to kill be established in those circumstances, but the person involved may be deemed to have acted in justifiable necessity, as he could not be sure of the intention of the thief. This does not, however, apply in broad daylight, as even the life of the thief is to be protected there. That is, in the dark you could kill the thief, in the daylight you would be guilty of murdering him. And so Exodus 22 tells us. Now, this understanding of self-defense is basic to Orthodox theology and Western jurisprudence. For instance, I read from Dabney's Practical Theology, page 446. The right of forcible self-defense exists, he says, even in private persons under the following circumstances: when the assailant evidently purposes malicious injury to life or limb or chastity. For the aggressor has unrighteously created a dilemma which obliges either the innocent or the guilty to suffer or die on the spot. for the state will certainly exact the murderer's life, and then two lives are wasted instead of one. Okay, or I read to you from the new Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge. Self-defense, defined as a defense which is requisite in order to ward off an illegal attack of which there is immediate danger. Therefore, since nobody can credibly claim that the fetus intends to kill its mother or is engaging in an assault against its mother with or without intention, the plea of self-defense in abortion is inapplicable and rationalizing. Nobody can seriously entertain thoughts of bringing charges against the fetus for murdering its mother, for the fetus does not willfully aggress against its mother. Can you imagine the fetus being in that situation? Proceeds the term, the mother dies, the fetus lives, and then when the child is old enough, we take it to court and accuse it of killing its mother. I mean, if you won't follow out your conclusion to that extreme and absurd conclusion, then you don't really believe your premise. In Jeremiah 2, verses 34 and 35, we see God's condemnation upon those who rationalize in these matters. Jeremiah 2, verses 34 and 35. Also in thy skirts is found the blood of the souls of the innocent poor. Thou didst not find them breaking in, but it is because of all these things. Yet thou sayest, I am innocent. Surely his anger is turned away from me. Behold, I will enter into judgment with thee, because thou sayest, I have not sinned. Jeremiah says, you have sinned, because the people you killed, you didn't find breaking into your home. It wasn't self-defense. We can't prove that the fetus, in fact, was trying to kill the mother. Then the plea of self-defense is rationalizing. Let's consider the following case. There is just enough medicine to keep either Mr. A or Mr. B alive. It turns out that Mr. B owns the medicine and will not give it to Mr. A in a self-sacrificial way. Now here we have a genuine case where the continued existence of Mr. B, who owns the medicine, poses a life threat to Mr. A. Mr. A can survive only if Mr. B does not survive. Now, certainly, A would not be justified in killing B for that necessary medicine. And A's plea of self-defense in a court of law would be rejected outright. While B's continued existence poses a threat to A's life, B has not attempted to take away A's life. That is, he hasn't shown any aggression or the intent to aggress against him. And therefore, A would have no justification before God or before the civil magistrate to kill B. Now, likewise, the continued existence of a fetus, even if it could be shown in this hypothetical case to pose a threat to the life of the mother, would not justify the killing of the fetus. Because, after all, if you could justify killing a fetus without aggression, you could justify killing Mr. B. Because it's just his existence that threatens the existence of Mr. A. God's law would ordinarily conceive of someone who kills another human being as guilty of murder unless the killing was without premeditation. Therefore, since the fetus is a human being with the right to be protected from assault, anyone who intentionally takes away its life is prima facie guilty of murder in the first degree. Indeed, if we accept the premature birth interpretation of Exodus 21, we learn from the Bible that it should be life for life. And so what I would argue is that in any case of abortion in our country today, if we were in the position to take the stand and to affect our culture, our position should be that any abortionist, the mother who submits to it and the doctor who performs it, are guilty of a capital crime, and they should be executed. Now that brings us to an interesting point. I was once asked by a purported theonomist who believes that when the mother's life is in danger, you can kill the fetus. I was once asked by him, well, do you really mean to say that if my wife is in that circumstance and I had the child taken, that you would bring me up on charges? Well, now let's look at the logic of our position. If we believe that abortionists should be executed by the civil magistrate, and if we believe that there is no legitimate right of self-defense against the fetus, then aren't we led to the conclusion that we'd be under moral obligation to bring people up on charges for engaging in any form of abortion? The only reason I bring this illustration to your mind is because I want you to see that we must be true to our premises. We must be as consistent with our premises as we are demanding of the abortionists when we use reductio ad absurdum arguments against them. Let's remember that God never does put us in a situation where we have to sin. 1 Corinthians 10:13, we're never in a situation where there's no way out, never in a situation where we have to murder either the mother or the fetus. And even if we were, we should never forget the possibility of altruistic self-sacrifice on the part of the mother. Even if it could be proven that there is a case where the mother might die, if the scripture does not condone the killing of an innocent child, one should be led to the conclusion that the mother should be willing to die for her children. And therefore, what I'm saying is, since there is neither a clear extra scriptural case for abortion, as we've seen in our earlier lecture, and there's no clear scriptural rationale for intentional abortion, no Christian can be confident that he or she can perform an abortion with God's approval. But if we can't be confident of God's approval, in that case, nobody can engage in an abortion in faith with a clear conscience. And therefore, on the basis of Romans 14:23, intentional abortion is always sinful. It can never be done in faith. Whatever's not of faith is sin. Yes.
Case in case here. You say meet a girl who is 40 years old. She tells you 20 years ago she had an abortion. She has since been converted. She admits to you that she's had an abortion. Is it your duty to exercise due process of law and bring her out to work?
Well, that all depends on the conditions of your scenario. If a woman 20 years later becomes a Christian, she's already had an abortion. That is the same as somebody who 20 years later is a Christian who has killed an individual. Okay, now, when would you prosecute the individual? Well, first of all, you wouldn't prosecute him if there was no law against the kind of murder he engaged in. I mean, there wouldn't be any law he violated. You couldn't prosecute him ex post facto, and you couldn't prosecute him if there wasn't sufficient evidence. But if there was sufficient evidence, if there was a law against abortion at the time, I'd say that there's no statute of limitations and that she should be prosecuted. As C.S. Lewis said, if I'm a converted murderer, I should be willing to undergo the due penalty for my crime, if I'm really a Christian. Thank you.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.